Right now, Silicon Valley is fighting over a $50 billion valuation for, a single software tool.
Yeah, just one tool that writes code.
Exactly. But then, halfway across the world, there's a geopolitical bottleneck over this really obscure chemical called bromine,
Right.
and it is literally threatening to physically melt down the very servers that software needs to even exist. So, welcome to the deep dive.
Glad to be here.
If you follow the tech industry, you know there is this persistent illusion of weightlessness, right? We use all this airy vocabulary like the cloud or wireless or virtual
Oh,
environments.
for sure. It sounds incredibly clean.
It does. It's like our digital lives just float up in the ether, completely detached from the physical world.
Well, we engineer that illusion intentionally. I mean, the entire goal of modern user experience is just frictionless scale.
Right.
You click a deploy button, and a sprawling application spins up across three continents in like
It's
milliseconds.
basically magic.
It feels like it. And it trains us to think of software as infinitely malleable, completely untethered from physical constraints. But the moment you look under the floorboards of a data center, you realize how incredibly heavy the digital world actually is.
Yeah.
It relies on dirt, physical cables, massive power grids, and really fragile global supply chains.
And that collision between the weightless software and the heavy physical reality is exactly what we are getting into today. We've got our stack of source material, the April 20, 2026 edition of Tech and AI Daily.
It's a packed edition today.
It really is. Our mission for this deep dive is to cut through the relentless noise of, daily product launches and really uncover the hidden threads connecting physical hardware shortages, massive AI valuations, and some pretty silent security leaks.
So by the end of this conversation, you're going to have a synthesized, big picture understanding of the current tech landscape.
Right. Because the contrast today is just stark.
It really is. We are looking at a spectrum that starts with raw chemical elements pulled out of the earth, and it ends with $50 billion speculative bets in San Francisco.
Let's start right there in the dirt, actually, because the foundation is cracking. We have a report from The Verge highlighting that the current RAM crunch is not just some temporary supply chain hiccup.
Yeah, what's not?
They're saying it is a multi-year structural shortage. And if you pair that with this fascinating piece from War on the Rocks, you uncover something called the Broman choke point.
Yeah, that was an eye-opening read.
So the Middle East supplies the vast majority of the world's bromine. And for anyone who hasn't taken chemistry recently, bromine is a critical flame retardant used in memory chip manufacturing.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. I look at the AI industry right now, and it feels like a company trying to build a massive fleet of the world's most advanced supercars.
Okay, I like that.
Right. Like,
Yeah.
they have the design, they have billions in funding, but they've suddenly realized the world is literally running out of spark plugs. And without spark plugs, the whole fleet is just grounded.
Well, what's fascinating here is that the supercar analogy is good, but the reality of the bromine shortage is actually much closer to running out of engine coolant.
Wait, really? Engine coolant?
Yeah. If you run the car without it, the engine block physically melts into slag.
Oh, wow.
You have to look at the thermodynamics of how modern AI inference works. Running these massive models requires high bandwidth memory, or HBM.
Right, which everyone is fighting over.
Exactly. To get the speeds AI requires, manufacturers stack these memory chips incredibly close together. The heat density in that microscopic space is staggering.
So it's literally just a heat problem.
Yes, and bromine is specifically required for the epoxy resins that encapsulate these chips. If you don't have that specific chemical flame retardant, the resin degrades, the layers delaminate, and the chip destroys itself under its own thermal load. Man, so if regional instability in the Middle East chokes off the bromine supply, we physically cannot build the cooling architecture for the memory chips.
Exactly.
And just to be super clear for you listening, we're not taking any political stance on the geopolitical situation in the Middle East here. We are just objectively reporting what the War on the Rocks piece points out about global supply chains.
Right, it's just the geographic reality of where the chemical is sourced. It creates a hard physical ceiling on software ambitions.
Which completely blows up the Silicon Valley assumption that compute will just naturally get cheaper and more abundant every year.
It does. If manufacturers can't source the epoxy resin, HBM yields drop. If memory yields drop, the cost to build a server rack skyrockets.
So what does that mean for the end user?
Well, for anyone listening who is building an application that relies on an API from Anthropic or OpenAI, this means you are going to face sustained upward pressure on inference costs.
you cannot plan your infrastructure budget on the assumption that AI compute will race to the bottom because the literal chemicals required to keep the processors from catching fire are caught in a geopolitical choke point.
It is so grounding. I mean, the Claret is literally just a computer in a heavily air-conditioned room that desperately needs flame retardants.
Pretty much.
But what's wild is that while we face these massive physical constraints on the ground, some companies are acting like there are absolutely no limits at all.
Oh, you mean Amazon?
Yes, Amazon. They just dropped $11.6 billion to acquire the satellite operator Globalstar.
A huge move.
Massive. It's a massive acceleration for their Kuiper satellite internet project, taking aim right at Starlink. Going back to our supercar analogy, Amazon isn't just building the car anymore.
Right.
They are buying the roads, the gas stations, and the airspace above the highway to ensure nobody else can drive.
That is vertical integration taken to its absolute planetary extreme.
Literally planetary.
Amazon's strategy is fundamentally about escaping earthbound choke points. If they own the satellite constellation, they control the internet backhaul.
Wow.
When you combine that with AWS ground stations, their data centers, and their custom silicon, they achieve full-stack dominance. They can ingest, process, and transmit data globally without ever touching a third-party network.
So we own the server and we own the sky.
Exactly.
But contrast that Amazon move with a report out of Swiss Info today. The Swiss government is actively exploring sovereign, open-source alternatives to Microsoft across all their public sector institutions.
Right. They are joining a growing wave of European governments trying to rethink big tech lock-in.
And again, we're strictly reporting the news here, not weighing in on U.S. versus European tech policy. But I look at this, and honestly, the European moves feel almost performative to me.
Really? Performative.
Like, good luck unplugging from American big tech when companies like Amazon are literally buying the stratosphere. So what does this all mean? Aren't these completely opposite visions of the future?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, calling it performative underestimates the very real concept of data gravity and statecraft.
Okay, how so?
The Swiss government and Europe broadly are looking at that exact full-stack dominance Amazon is building and realizing it represents an unacceptable single point of failure.
Ah, I see.
It is not about anti-American sentiment. It is about operational continuity. When a single corporation owns the entire stack from the sky to the spreadsheet, any change in their terms of service or compliance with a foreign law can cripple a sovereign nation's public sector.
So it's the ultimate fear of vendor lock-in, just on a geopolitical scale.
Precisely. If a government relies entirely on a closed ecosystem, they have essentially outsourced their digital sovereignty.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The pivot toward open source isn't about finding a shinier software tool. It is a slow, difficult mechanism to ensure that if the corporate cloud goes dark, the country's hospitals and power grids don't go down with it.
But here's where the logic breaks for me a little bit. Even if European governments successfully build their own physical infrastructure and sovereign data centers, they're still going to crash into the exact same problem everyday developers face right now.
The software vulnerabilities.
Yes. The software layer running on top of those servers is inherently porous. The news today on the security front is incredibly grim. We have two major items.
The Vercel and Notion stories.
Yeah. First, Bleeping Computer reports that Vercel has confirmed a security breach where hackers are actively selling stolen data.
Which is bad enough.
But the second one, breaking from OSINT researchers on Twitter, is what really drives me crazy. Notion is silently leaking the registered email addresses of every single editor on all public-facing pages.
Yeah, that one is rough.
It's not even a hack. Wait, so if you collaborate on a public doc, your email is just hanging out there for anyone to scrape. That's not a breach. That's just a feature working terribly. It feels like gross negligence.
Well, we need to separate these into two distinct categories of vulnerability because the mechanisms behind them require completely different responses from developers.
Okay, let's break them down.
The Vercel situation is an active exploit. Someone bypassed security controls to exfiltrate data.
Right.
Since Vercel is the central nervous system for so much of the modern front-end ecosystem, the immediate action for the listener is clear. If you have environment variables or access tokens hosted there, you must assume they are compromised and rotate your keys immediately.
Right, so that is a traditional breach. But explain the Notion leak to me. How does a platform that sophisticated just broadcast user emails?
So the Notion leak is an architectural flaw, specifically a data overfetching issue.
Overfetching?
Yeah. When you visit a public Notion page, you see the display names of the people who edited it. But behind the scenes, the browser doesn't just ask the Notion API for the display names, it asks for the user data.
Oh.
And the API, working exactly as it was coded, sends the entire JSON user object to the front end.
The whole object.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
That object includes the registered email address. The front end interface politely hides the email and only displays the name, but the data is sitting right there in the network traffic.
Some malicious actor doesn't need to break through a firewall or steal a password. They just open their browser's developer tools and read the network tab.
Exactly. And at scale, automated scrapers harvest those JSON objects by the millions.
That is insane.
It's a gold mine for spear phishing. If an attacker knows your email, your specific role, and the exact context of the internal documentation you are editing, they can craft an incredibly convincing phishing campaign.
Wow.
The takeaway here is that we trust these platforms with complex security, but a simple API overfetching bug on a public share setting can compromise an entire team.
Yeah.
If you use Notion, you must operate under the assumption that your email address is already in a targeted database.
So the hardware is melting down for lack of chemicals, governments are fleeing the cloud, and the software we rely on is actively leaking.
It's a tough day for tech.
And yet, the financial markets seem completely disconnected from this reality. I mean, the AI sector is running hotter than ever.
The numbers are staggering.
They really are. According to Bloomberg, Cursor is in talks to raise $2 billion at a $50 billion valuation. $50
billion. Wow.
With backers like A16's Thrive and NVIDIA. Meanwhile, you have DeepSeek, the Chinese team, behind the highly efficient R1 model, raising their first outside capital of $300 million at a valuation just over $10 billion.
Quite a contrast.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I think the Cursor valuation is a massive bubble.
You think so?
Cursor is a brilliant code editor. I mean, it's essentially an IDE. But if the entire industry is moving toward agent-native development, where AI agents just write, test, and deploy the code base in the background, the editor itself becomes totally irrelevant.
Right.
How do you justify a $50 billion price tag on a tool that might be obsolete? It feels like valuing a company that makes the world's best typewriter right as the word processor is being invented.
This raises an important question, though. That theory assumes the transition to fully autonomous coding happens overnight, which ignores the actual mechanics of software development.
Okay.
You have to look at what these two companies represent. DeepSeek absolutely rattled Silicon Valley because they represent brutal capital efficiency.
Yeah, their R1 model was crazy efficient.
They built it using an incredibly sparse mixture of experts and heavily optimized reinforcement learning. They proved you don't need a cluster of 100,000 GPUs to reach state-of-the-art performance.
Right.
A $300 million war chest for a team that efficient is terrifying to incumbents spending billions.
Because they figured out how to do it lean. They aren't just throwing brute compute at the problem.
Correct. Now, contrast that capital efficiency with Cursor's $50 billion price tag. Cursor's valuation is a massive bet that AI is not yet an autonomous worker, but rather a highly capable intern that requires a senior developer to supervise it.
I see the distinction.
In that dynamic, the IDE isn't just a text editor. It is the context engine. It manages the human-computer interaction, highlighting where the AI might have hallucinated a dependency or broken a build.
So they're betting on the human staying in the loop.
Exactly. Cursor has to prove that human-in-the-loop editing will remain the dominant workflow for the next 5 to 10 years. If developers stop reading code and just start managing agents, as you suggested, then Cursor is a stepping stone.
Yeah.
As a listener assessing your own workflows, you have to ask yourself, are you still a typist, or are you becoming a manager of AI agents?
That is a great way to frame it. To really understand who is going to win that race between human-in-the-loop and fully autonomous agents, we really have to look at what is happening under the hood of the foundation models themselves.
The token optimization stuff.
Yeah. The community is obsessed with how these models are secretly being refined. Simon Willison has a brilliant dissection today, pulling apart the system prompt differences between Anthropic's Claude Opus version 4.6 and the newly released 4.7.
It's fascinating work.
There is this anonymous leaderboard benchmarking the request token usage between these two versions, and it hit 598 points on Hacker News today.
Huge engagement.
But I look at this and wonder, for those of us not building AI wrappers, why does shedding 50 tokens from a system prompt matter so much?
Well,
is it basically the AI equivalent of giving an employee a slightly revised HR handbook and seeing if they work faster? Or is it just Anthropic trying to save a fraction of a cent on compute costs across millions of API calls?
The HR handbook analogy is great. Cost savings are a byproduct, but the real engineering victory is about attention mechanisms and the KV cache.
The KV cache.
Yeah. To understand why developers are accessing over a 50-token difference, you have to know how a system prompt fundamentally interacts with a large language model.
Okay, walk me through it.
The system prompt is the invisible set of instructions, the model's persona, its boundaries, its formatting rules, that gets computed before the user even types a word.
Right, so it is the HR handbook for the AI.
A very literal HR handbook. Every single token in that system prompt takes up space in the model's context window.
Yeah.
And more importantly, it requires computation for the key value cache, or KV cache, for every single turn of the conversation.
Okay, so if it's bloated.
If a system prompt is bloated with ambiguous instructions, the model's attention heads are constantly dividing their computational focus between the user's actual prompt and the lengthy behavioral guidelines.
So by stripping out 50 tokens of vague instruction and replacing it with tighter logic gates,
Anthropic frees up the attention mechanism to focus entirely on the user's code generation.
Oh, wow.
Changing a single word from ensure to must in a system prompt can shift the probability distribution of the entire subsequent output.
That is wild.
It reduces hallucinations because the model is less distracted by its own bloated instructions. For anyone listening who builds tools on top of these models, tracking these subtle token optimizations isn't just trivia.
Right. It's essential. Now,
if you route thousands of queries a day, a quietly updated system prompt changes your application's reliability overnight.
It really is the modern equivalent of studying the manual for a new microprocessor to squeeze out every drop of performance.
Exactly.
Which actually brings us to a perfect grounding point. With AI moving at this breakneck, completely unprecedented speed, literally tracking invisible token optimizations week to week, I actually found it incredibly refreshing to look at a piece of tech news today that is entirely backward-looking.
Context in technology is everything. The cycles always repeat.
They really do. And I completely geeked out over this last piece. The complete archive of BYT Magazine, starting from issue number one all the way back in 1975, is now freely browsable on the Internet Archive.
Such a great resource.
The hacker community loved it too. It scored 496 points on HN. As someone who devours old tech history, reading the thoughts of builders from an era before the internet even existed is wild.
It's a completely different world.
They are talking about physical kilobyte limitations and the mechanics of soldering their own motherboards. It feels so distant, but also weirdly similar to the token optimization we just talked about.
The tools have completely shifted, but the fundamental builder mindset remains exactly the same.
Yeah, that's so true.
It reveals a massive continuum of constraint-driven innovation. In 1975, the constraint was physical memory and the dexterity required to solder logic gates.
Right.
Today, the constraint is the context window and the cost of inference. The people reverse engineering Anthropic system prompts today are driven by the exact same curiosity as the hardware hackers reading BYTE in their garages 50 years ago.
Just tinkering with whatever is in front of them.
Exactly. They want to know how the machine works. They want to understand the limitations of the architecture, and they want to push it past its intended design.
So what does this all mean when we put the pieces together? We started deep in the dirt with the thermodynamics of memory chips, realizing how a lack of bromine in the Middle East can halt the entire AI hardware boom. We looked up at the sky, watching Amazon spend billions to achieve full-stack dominance, while European nations desperately try to untangle themselves from big tech data gravity.
Right.
We waded through the software layer, finding that APIs like Notions are quietly overfetching our private data straight into the hands of scrapers. We questioned the $50 billion bet on human coders at Cursor going up against the lean, capital-efficient architecture of DeepSeek.
That's a lot.
It is. We looked under the hood at how shedding 50 tokens from Claude Opus changes the attention mechanisms of an entire model. And finally, we saw that exact same hacker DNA reflected in a 1975 issue of BYTE magazine.
The through line here is fragility and dependency. You cannot understand the software boom without understanding the physical supply chain and the architectural flaws that support it.
Definitely.
Which leaves us with a critical reflection for the listener. We've talked about a $50 billion coding tool today, but we've also unpacked how a single chemical flame retardant could completely throttle the servers that tool runs on.
Right. As you analyze your own tech stack or your business operations or even your daily workflows, What is your hidden bromine choke point? What is that invisible, deeply buried dependency that, if it were suddenly removed, brings your entire system crashing down?
That is the ultimate question. We love the illusion of weightless magic, but eventually you have to look at the x-ray, you have to see the heavy bones of the system, and you have to know exactly where the fractures might happen. Thank you so much for coming along on this deep dive with us today.
Thanks for listening. Look for those hidden dependencies, audit your public APIs, and most importantly, stay insanely curious until next time.